once more into the breach, dear friends, else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jake and...
Jeff.
McClure. We are the bald duo. We are here to fearlessly interpret economic news, boldly state our opinions as if they matter.
I don't know that it's fearless.
You're afraid?
Yes, I am.
Can you...
I might say something wrong. I might...
You just literally said something wrong.
I did. See, right there.
Yeah. You brought your fear to life. That was a self-fulfilling prophecy there. You were afraid that you would say something wrong, and then you said something wrong.
I did.
We are the Personal Wealth Coach, and... if you haven't figured it out, we're a little strange. We're going to be talking about the world of finance, investing, economics, what's going on in the world, what's going on in your wallet. Wait, how do we know what's happening in your wallet? But before we get started, we've got some disclosures. The Personal Wealth Coach is not just the name of this radio program. It's also the name... It's not only... I did say it's not just the name of this radio program. It is the name of the radio program.
Right. Got it.
Okay. People who speak English as a second language have to be confused by us constantly. You just said it was the name of the radio program, and then you said it's not just the name of the radio program. It's also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm.
That's an interesting coincidence.
It is. It is... They do coincide, but they were intentionally coinciding. So the Personal Wealth Coach as an SEC-registered investment advisor gives fiduciary investment advice to people of high net worth. This is not investment advice, what we're giving on the air, because we don't know you all, I don't think. Maybe if we just have a few, we might just have like three listeners that we know every one of them this week.
You really think we have that many?
I'm not listening and you're not listening. So that maybe it's just one listener at this point.
Well, I guess if you're listening and I'm listening and we had one listener out there, that would make us three listeners.
What did you say? I'm sorry. I wasn't listening.
I know. I got you.
We're killing our own ratings by not listening to ourselves.
Yep.
I don't even hear the words that are coming out of my own mouth.
True.
So what I'm trying to say there is that fiduciary investment advice requires us to actually know you and to tailor the advice to your best interest. And the fact that we're on the radio means that it's unlikely that we can do that. So what we're offering on the radio is not investment advice, it's education. We are hopefully going to enlighten you and inform your decision-making process. We do take questions on that, by the way. I'm going to throw this in the middle of the disclosures. You can email us your questions. We've already got several waiting to Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com, as in thepersonalwealthcoach.com, or Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie.
You can send it to both of them too. You can send it to Jeff at tpwc.com and Jake at tpwc.com. That way we both get it.
That's actually preferable. Now, I said that the firm is registered with the SEC. That in no way says that the SEC has given some kind of a thumbs up approval or hidden wink, wink, nudge, nudge to us in any way. That just means they're the folks that will come and smack us around if we do something wrong and you report us and they say, well, it's more like they ask us to write a big check or to stop doing business, period. Or possibly if in cases of egregious wrongdoing, the SEC will provide the whole gated community experience with free room and board and nice orange clothing. It's not something I would recommend, but it is on the itinerary of notable people like Bernie Madoff and folks like him.
Well, not anymore. He's dead.
Well, but it was on his itinerary.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. So that's nice little things. And we're glad that the SEC is out there, but they don't give a thumbs up to anything. So that's part of our disclosure. Whenever someone says they're registered with a government agency, sometimes they seem to think that gives them some kind of authority. but it's kind of like saying, I register my taxes with the IRS. Well, that doesn't mean that the IRS agrees that you did your taxes right. It just means that they accepted a check from you. So that's with the SEC, it's a little bit more involved than that, but it's the same concept. Would you like to give us your favorite disclosure?
The information we present on this radio program, and it's an educational program, so it's educational information, has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information, which is my favorite disclosure.
Yes. And I'm actually going to add to it a little bit. Sometimes we gather information from sources we deem to be totally and completely unreliable.
We do?
Yeah, but we generally bring that information to you to point out how it is totally and completely unreliable. For instance, I quite often will quote from Chinese publications. Those are not, in my opinion, considered reliable.
I didn't even know you spoke Chinese.
I don't, but Google does, and he helps a lot. He's a great guy, except when he's not. I guess it's like your cousins or whatever. They're great until they're not. We've got one more disclosure, and that is that we do not pay for this radio program. Nor are we paid to do the radio program. We do buy advertising on the station, but the advertising is for the radio program, and the station also provides advertising for the radio program. So there is no quid pro quo, Senator, if there's a senator listening. And if you'd know what that's from, it's dating you already.
Means you're really old.
Or at least semi-old. All right, so you want to start out what happened in the market this week?
Well, market zigzagged around a bit and then was up zero. The Standard & Poor's 500 stock index, at least, was up 0.61% for the week, which doesn't sound like much. You know, it's a 0.6%. But then when you figure there's 52 weeks in the year, you multiply that times 52, and it goes, wow, that's a lot of return. It's actually up about the average it's been so far because it's up 12.61% year to date. Why did it zig down on Thursday? Because there was an inflation scare.
But it's like every Thursday we have an inflation scare so far in the last, I don't know, 2 months. It's like every Thursday we're like, oh, inflation. Oh, no, never mind. Oh, inflation.
On
Friday, never mind.
They decided, then Friday the market decided there wasn't an inflation scare and it came back, and it came back more than went down, which means it went up for the week. 12.61% year to date. If we just keep on doing this 0.61% a week all year, it'll be pretty interesting. We'll have a massive market gain, which we've already had the last 12 months.
We're not suggesting that that's going to happen, but it brings into light when we talk about a weekly return. It brings into light pretty easily that these are high returns.
The S&P 500 is only 0.6% below its all-time record, which it hit about a month ago. The reason the market, the reason at least is reported by the Wall Street Journal and other sources that the market is behaving so oddly, zigzagging up and down, is it's looking for something to be afraid of. The market is up. Is it up out of sight? Not by historic standards. It's up. It's near the top of its normal trading range. And basically is dependent on the fact that we'll have higher earnings in the future, which is a pretty good thing to be dependent upon, since the corporate earnings reports that have come in from the first quarter almost all have led to guidance that they'll have much higher earnings in the second and third quarters and fourth quarters.
And it's so, not a stretch to believe that, as that more and more people are vaccinated and feel safe going out and actually are going out. 1 in 3 Texans are fully vaccinated at this point, which is pretty cool. Texas is not at the leading edge of that curve. There are states that are above 70% fully vaccinated as well. And those states are seeing a pretty tremendous boom back to economic activity. So is Texas. So having expectations for higher earnings throughout the year is a pretty reasonable expectation, unless we get some kind of another shutdown. It's really easy to grow from what we were last year, because last year was pretty down.
And by the way, this leveling off period that we've been going through with relatively small gains on average in a week and little scares in the middle of the week, it's really, really good. That's an indication that the bull market still has room to run. There's no guarantees, of course. The bottom line to it is, the old saw is true. A bull market climbs a wall of worry. As long as there's worry and fear in the market, we're probably still in a bull market, so we're doing really well. Interestingly enough to us, and we think it's important because we're mid-cap value guys, the CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index hit a new record this week, closing at 2508.92. Actually, it hit the record on Thursday. It closed at 2509, up over 1% this week. And it's up 22.31% year-to-date. Now, that indicates there's a rotation going on in the market. The mid-cap values part of the S&P 500 has had almost twice the return of the main S&P 500. What we saw last year was the large-cap growth side of the S&P 500 getting all the returns. So there's a rotation going on in the market out of the very big growth tech companies into the value companies, particularly mid-cap value. Actually, small-cap value has done exceptionally well, but that's not in the S&P 500. It's a normal rotation, by the way, mid-bull market. And so this bull market is behaving in a fairly normal fashion, unlike the economy. The 10-year U.S. Treasury note yield confirmed, as we wrote in the newsletter, no inflation in sight. It declined to 1.55%, which sounds pretty, if you've been around very long, that's an amazingly low interest rate for a 10-year U.S. Treasury note. But it's down from 1.63% in May. Why did it go down? Basically, a lot of people are buying U.S. Treasury notes. Why are they buying U.S. Treasury notes? Because they've got about the highest yield in the world of anything that's virtually guaranteed. Even though it looks like inflation is running above 1.55%, and probably the bet of people who are investing in those Treasury notes is they'll do a break even over a 10-year period. So basically, and this is rough and it's not particularly accurate, but people who are buying those Treasury notes and thereby forcing the interest rates down are thinking that the average inflation is going to be about 1.5% over the next 10 years. Otherwise, they'd be losing money in buying Treasury notes. They're doing it anyway. Short-term rates, and that's an important thing, which the Federal Reserve has some control over. If you actually look at the maturity values and the current price of bonds on the open market, Treasury bonds, notes, and bills on the open market that will mature in the next 6 months, they're all around 101. What that means is if you paid $1,010 for a Treasury note today, it's going to mature in 5 or 6 months, and you only get $1,000 back, and you don't get any interest on it over that period. You actually lose money. In some cases, you do get the interest, and in some cases, you don't. But the bottom line to it is, the actual yield to maturity on Treasury securities in the secondary market for 6 months is negative. The 30-year Treasury, on the other hand, is up at 2.24%, which still sounds amazingly low to a guy who's been around as long as I have. But that's a steep yield curve going from 0 to 2.254% with 1.55 in the middle of 10 years. That tells us that the Treasury market, the people who buy Treasury bonds, the people and organizations that buy Treasury bonds, think there's a lot of growth, but very little long-term inflation ahead. And it looks, and an interesting point about this Treasury yield curve, and I don't expect most people to appreciate this very much, but the yield curve looks like this at the bottom of a recession normally, where the short-term rates go to zero or nearly to zero because things are so bad. Long-term rates are significantly higher because they expect things to get good. And that steep yield curve that we have starting at zero where we are right now is the kind of yield curve that you typically see dead at the bottom of a bear market or a recession. And it is really odd to see this kind of yield curve appear or shape up and form as it has this far into a recovery.
It's one of the leading indicators that we would look at and say, this means that we're still close to the beginning of the recovery.
The labor market is saying the recovery may be partially over, but I don't agree with that. I think the labor market is going to heal itself pretty quickly. But the point is, everything out there is saying, all the indicators, all the economic indicators are telling us that as far as the economic cycle is concerned, we're just getting started. We're just getting on a roll. There's some other economic information that tells us that, but that's not the market. West Texas Intermediate crude oil rose 2% for the week to $69.35, again, on evidence of increasing demand, which is in the way the crude oil market says, hey, the economy is picking up steam.
Yeah.
Prices rise.
We're running right close to $70 a barrel at this point. And if you go back just over a year, it was a -$ a barrel. Negative, what was it, $25 a barrel?
It actually hit -$35 at one point.
So worst case scenario back then, you had to pay somebody to take it off your hands. You had to pay somebody $30 to take the barrel away or to have a barrel, period. And today, people are paying you $70 to buy the same amount. It's just fascinating. It's one of the things when we look at the year-over-year returns in the market of almost anything, they look unrealistic because we were so low last year at this point. We were already beginning the recovery in the market last year at this point, but it was still pretty down. So anytime you look at your investment returns for the year, it's going to look really nice if you were experiencing the market at all. Just know that that's not a realistic return forever. That this is a pretty good statement that we were really down then and almost everything is up today from then. So we've got some questions that are out there waiting for us. Shall we start them? The first question we had was way early, more than an hour before the program began. Alan sent in a question, and the subject of the email is new Natrium power plant in Wyoming. Jeff, Jake, I've read a couple of articles about this new nuclear technology this week. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this new way of producing electricity. I'm going to answer this really broadly because there are dozens of exciting new nuclear technologies out there. And when I say exciting, this is not hyperbole. This is stuff that's completely new ways of approaching nuclear energy. So I'm approaching this broadly. In the United States, we're in the process of making one nuclear power plant in Wyoming. And it's exciting because we're using new technology to do it with. This technology was developed over the last about four decades in the United States at the academic level. So there's not a lot of practice. A lot of the nuclear power stations that have been built during that time period are using an older technology because you have to have your plant approved 20 years in advance to get it built in the United States. And that's not hyperbole either. If you just start looking around at when, for instance, there's a nuclear power plant near Matagorda, Texas. And if you want to look at how long it took to get that thing going, the actual construction on it took less than a year if you just put all the construction together into one time frame. So lots and lots of new and innovative technology coming out in nuclear power, and we're not going to experience much of it. It'd be nice if we did, but people are afraid of nuclear. And they're not likely to ever get over that fear. I think it's overblown, but it is a fear that people have. They would much rather use other means than nuclear, unless you're talking about China. China right now is in the process of creating about three times the rest of the world's combined nuclear power plants in the next few years. And by the next few years, they have a plan that's listed out that's looking out over the next five-year plan. This is China's 14th five-year plan that they put out. And this one covers 2021 to 2025. It was released in March. So when people talk to, you know, when we say we deem these things to be reliable, we deem this to be the official release from the Chinese. It's not necessarily going to be what they do, but they've been pretty much on track to following their own plans. And they plan to reach a 70 gigawatt gross nuclear capacity by the end of 2025. It's currently at 50 gigawatts, so they're adding 20 gigawatts over the next 5 years. But they're planning on adding a significantly more. And gigawatts, by the way, it sounds like we're talking computer speech or something. Gigawatts is a lot. A megawatt is a million watts. A gigawatt, you're now up in the billion range. They're adding 20 gigawatt capacity per year to the grid over the next 5 years. That's why am I bringing up China in the middle of this? Because China has, and this is numbers from nextbigfuture.com, which is a really good way of tracking new innovations and so on. And they have a very big focus on what's happening in China. There are 17 reactors under construction right now in China, actually under construction. And there's another 40 plus that are planned to get started in the next 5 years. So you're talking about 57 plants under construction or planned to be under construction in the next 5 years. In the United States, it's one. And there's a list of other countries that are in the process of making them. Let me see. There's two in Pakistan, one in Romania, two in Argentina, one in the UK, one in Iran, one in Turkey, one in South Africa, Kenya, Egypt, Sudan, Armenia, and Kazakhstan. So
we're neck and neck with Armenia
and Kazakhstan. Yeah.
And Sudan.
Right. Now, not really, because Armenia, Kazakhstan, and Sudan are using Russian technology, which is not very efficient, where the Chinese are using American technology for their power plants, their nuclear power plants, and the United States is using U.S. technology. The U.K. is using U.K. technology. So, and it's just as good as American technology there. It's just completely different. And when I say there's dozens of new types of technology out there, that is not exaggeration. There's just an amazing amount of new ways of doing nuclear power that are safer and portable and easier to clean up. And there's all kinds of good things that have happened over the last 40 years in technology. We're not likely to experience it. Just like Germany and Japan are not likely to experience it. There's just not an appetite for nuclear energy in the United States. Now, on a different note, TAE Technologies is talking about having fully operational nuclear fusion plant by 2030. They produced a stable plasma at 50 million degrees Celsius with a compact reactor, and have repeated that hundreds of times. Fusion is here. This is something that has been a pipe dream for many, many, many years, going back to the 1950s, when everybody said we're going to have it in the next fill in the blank. The reality is it's been a lot harder to figure out. But at the end of this, there are, again, dozens of companies with fusion reactors that are likely to come on in the next 10 years. That's a completely game-changing concept. It is completely different than anything we've discovered before. It's expensive to make, but that's thought, just like other things, that the prices are going to come down on that. Total funding for this project that we're talking about with TAE Technologies is right now is about $880 million, which is fractional cost to a fission plant, what we would normally call nuclear. We're talking billions on billions for one plant, and fusion energy is far more robust and far cheaper once it gets on a larger amount. So this is not pie in the sky stuff. This is not pipe dream stuff anymore. Fusion's coming. The future of energy is good, kind of across the board. We've talked in the past several months about the transition that's taken place lately in solar and wind energy, that it is now cheaper in many, many respects than coal, without subsidies even being considered. And that technology is only going to continue to be better. Battery technology is getting better. There's a bunch of stuff came out this week on something called aluminum ion or aluminum air batteries. They're not technically a battery at all, and I could go into great detail on that. But it's about 10 times the energy density of the lithium ion battery. What that means is that if you're in a car and your Model S can take you 300 miles on a charge, if you had, instead of a lithium ion, an aluminum ion, you're talking about 3,000 miles on a charge. Again, not a pipe dream. There's some logistical issues in that the battery, the pieces inside the battery, the aluminum itself has to be replaced. The water in the battery has to be replaced. But it's all recyclable. So there's a lot of amazing and cool energy stuff coming out in the future. And I've spent way too long on this one question.
Let's go back to the natrium reactor again. The difference between a natrium reactor and a traditional water-cooled reactor is fairly simple. Well, there's no such thing as fairly simple
in nuclear physics.
But the important thing is that it's cooled with liquid sodium, which is referred to as natrium, rather than water. And why is that important? Liquid sodium, unlike water, does not pick up radioactivity when it circulates through the power plant. When it circulates through the reactor, it picks up the heat, which is needed to be.
You need to keep it cool.
Keep it cool, and it can recycle it into other places, but it doesn't take the radioactivity with it. It does occasionally, there's a little bit of radioactivity in it, but it decays within 15 hours to no radioactivity. So if there were a spill at a natrium power plant, you just have a lot of salt on the ground, but you wouldn't have radioactive salt on the ground. If you think about it,
you just have to keep the salt away from the batteries, or then you get salt and battery and you could go to jail.
This is the salt, which is different.
Okay. Not a salt, just the salt. Okay. Right. All right. Never mind.
And it's important to have these. I think Bill Gates has funded this program to work on natrium power. He calls it, natrium is actually a brand name. And it actually works very, very well. And it is much safer than a regular power plant. It is less corrosive, less likely to create anything that would cause damage to the environment or release radioactivity. It still has the problem of the fact that when you're done with the fuel, you got to do something with it. There's been a lot of objection to doing anything with it, which is one of the problems we have in the United States. The United States government built a big facility in Nevada. In one of their test areas where nobody goes, where there's no water, putting it thousands of feet underground, sealed in glass blocks, and still people objected about it.
Well, you got to get it there, and that's the thing they're objecting. Yeah, we don't want that stuff on our railroads. Don't bring it. No. You just leave it where it is.
Put it in the glass blocks, and it's safe. You can drop it from an airplane even in these glass blocks.
Has that been tested? Well, I think we need to have a government test where they actually take the radioactive material and tell the people that we're going to test and make sure that the block works. We're going to drop it from an airplane. I don't think people would agree to that. What do you think?
Actually, they actually did drop them from airplanes. So they didn't have radioactive material in them, but they dropped them to see if they would break. They didn't. That's the point. There are safe ways of dealing with this, but people are so paranoid about it. It's kind of like irradiating meat. Irradiating meat using x-rays does not leave the meat full of x-rays or full of radioactivity, but people still don't like it. It does clean out all the bacteria, which stop a lot of deaths from food poisoning during the years, but people don't like it anyway. People are just natively afraid of anything that has to do with radioactivity.
Just as long as it's not gamma radiation, because then the meat could all get green and big if it gets mad and start punching things. This is from purely scientific sources for sure. That Marvel,
purely science fiction sources at Marvel, right?
Yeah. I'm marveling at this stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we are really. I'm pro nuclear, but I'm also pro a tax that is fair. I recognize in being pro something that, especially in cases like those two items, it's not likely to be picked up by the public. We're not likely to have a tax that makes any sense, or a nuclear power, major nuclear power in the United States at this point. I expect that to be waning as a size of our electric grid. Before we go to the next question, though, I wanted to update a question we had last week. Last week, we were asked what the Texas legislature did to fix the grid. And last week, they had some bills that went to conference, which is where the Senate and the House have committees together to see how they can duct tape their bills together and kind of make it look like one bill. And with the Democrat walkout at that point, we didn't think it was going to get finalized. It got finalized. Now, what came out of it is definitely a duct tape together bit of legislation. I'm not going to call it a monster because it's got some good pieces in it. It's a combination of multiple Senate bills and multiple House bills, which makes it that they were only in conference for a very short period of time, which means that the bill that was voted on probably is full of problems. But some of the key takeaways is that the legislature is requiring weatherization of quite a few natural gas production facilities and quite a lot of energy production facilities. This is good news. They're also, and the requirement is somewhere between $2 and $3 billion overall across the entire state. And they're also allowing this to be paid for through bonds from the companies that are doing the work. So they would be issuing bonds based on their customer funds, who's paying for the energy. So it's a different kind of municipal bond that will be issued to pay for this stuff. And overall, across Texas, it should be, according to the legislature, no more than about $3 billion. So expect to see your electricity rates jump a little bit, not much. Because across the state, we're only talking about $3 or $4 a month difference to pay for this sort of thing. So on that note, we got good things that happened for the power grid. There were other things that had been talked about that were really great ideas of having reserve production sites. Warren Buffett had proposed that only turn on when things are bad, so that you have, in essence, a 15% reserve capacity sitting and waiting in the background. There were thoughts that the legislature would dip into the rainy day fund to help weatherize, which sort of made sense to me when you talk about weatherization and rainy day.
They didn't. But it wasn't a rainy day. It was an icy day.
Oh, yeah.
You don't have an icy day fund.
And I think that was the final argument that was used, that this was not a rain issue. This was an ice issue. So the rainy day fund was not tapped for this. Two of the bills had that as a major component. So what we got was not really expected, but it's the sausage that takes place when you dealing with politics. So the sausage is likely to be rather tasty in that hopefully it will prevent massive freezing of our electric grid a second time. We'll see. It might be too little. It might be just enough. $2 to $3 billion is on the low end of what a lot of the private organizations were estimating the cost to weatherize would be. So they're only requiring some degree of weatherization.
They also required that the gas production facilities, all the way from the ground through the pumping facilities and the refinement facilities that are necessary to generate electric power, be listed as emergency power need, so they don't get shut off like they did last time.
That's right. And weatherization of the direct pipelines.
We definitely got caught with their pants down around our ankles on them, because a lot of the places that produce natural gas to supply the electric power grid were not listed as emergency power requirement.
Because they hadn't filed the right paperwork.
They shut them off. And nobody was in charge of making sure that that happened. Well, now, technically, the Texas Railroad Commission is in charge of making that happen. And then now one of the problems is the ERCOT and the Texas Railroad Commission are not the same thing, and they often work at odds with each other.
Right.
They also restructured ERCOT to where the governor gets to nominate the members of ERCOT or appoint them, as opposed to the industry appointing them.
Which is probably a better deal, in that you at least can vote somebody out that appointed the wrong people, instead of just say, oh, that was a bad idea. You actually can vote about it. That's kind of nice.
Well, you can actually vote for the governor. if he appoints the wrong people.
Right.
That's about it.
That's what I mean. You could vote that the governor should stop that somehow. Wow. We spent a lot of time on energy, didn't we? So we're going to play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side. We've got questions on bond indexes, on public and private debt versus GDP. Some compliments. Somebody has given us compliments, which is very nice.
Really?
Yeah.
That's scary.
So we'll be back on the other side of these commercials. If you want to ask us a question, the emails are jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com. And we'll be back on the other side. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and
Jeff
McClure. Wow, we actually said that together. Although you probably didn't hear it that way.
No, I heard it. I heard me saying it first, which meant you said it at the same time.
Yeah, we got lag between your phone and mine, and then between my phone and the studio.
Our latency.
Latent lag.
I like latency better.
What about lagency?
I don't think that's a word.
So, John, our most faithful questioner, which almost sounds like an oxymoron, you're faithfully questioning us constantly. Stop questioning us! No, we actually prefer the questions. Thank you. His first question is a really easy answer. He has a question about the bond move index. And it's a measure of bond market volatility. And his question is, how widely is this index used? And an answer to that is to say, number one, the breadth of people that are looking at the bond market on a daily basis is already pretty narrow. You throw in the fact that the bond market absolutely dwarfs the stock market as far as the number of bond issues out there. It is just huge. People are like, how can it be that much bigger? Well, Ford Motor has stock that you can buy, and it may even have multiple share classes, maybe two or three. If you're looking at Google, there's three share classes, but they've only got three share classes. Soon as you start getting into bonds, it's every issue of every debt they've ever had. When it matures, if they issue debt, if Ford issued debt 29 years ago as a 30-year bond, then you have a 30-year bond maturing in 1 year, and they may have gotten other debt in the same year. So the number of debt issues at the company level, if they get a small loan and then they get a big loan and then they get different maturity values at different time periods and different rates, you're starting to talk about, just for one company, thousands of different bond issues. And then you throw in the fact that municipal, like cities, states, toll roads, they don't issue stock usually. They may issue dozens of different debt securities, debt obligations, which means that the bond market is, to put it extremely lightly, massive. It is really, really big. There's not a good index to track that market. I wish there was. There's really not a good index to track the volatility of the market. But if you are trading in the relatively narrow area of the bond market that is tracked by the MOVE Index, almost always it's used. How's that for you?
Basically, you're not betting on bonds. You're in a MOVE Index, you're buying options. based on how volatile you think the bond market is going to be. And there's professional traders who do that, and there are corporations who do that. But how widely followed is it? Not as widely as the VIX, which measures the volatility of the stock market. Even that's pretty esoteric.
Right.
Basically, you can make a bet using an option that you think the stock market will be more or less volatile into the future. If that sounds like the investment world is very similar to a casino, you're right.
All right. So on to the next question. Hopefully that question was well answered. The bond market is big. And so widely used indicators have a different meaning. There's not a huge number of people that track all of the bond market. Nobody can track the entirety of the bond market. It's not possible at this point.
Well, there's a total bond index.
Yeah. But it's not tracking the entirety of the bond market. It's not even close because you've got different maturities across the whole spectrum. So it doesn't make sense to use, it's not like the S&P 500 where you can just say this is the movement of these stocks. Because you got to throw in yield to maturities and different durations. This is complex and a lot. So the next question is public and private debt versus GDP. And his question is, how does the U.S. compare to China on this critical metric? Debt to GDP is a really good number to sort of get a broad swag at. Even in the United States, when you have the Federal Reserve involved in helping to measure this stuff, there's still a lot of debt that's not measured by the Federal Reserve. This is just important to know that when you're talking about China, you're really getting into a vague area. What we can say about China is that the Chinese debt to GDP, and this is according to South China Morning Post. How's that for you? It's depending on which measurement you're using, somewhere between 300 and 450% of GDP for the totality of debt in China. That's the government debt and the private debt all added together. Where in the United States, it's pretty closely pegged at about the 330% number. The number in the Wall Street Journal that's been circled is 300% of GDP for China. But it's kind of, even in that statement, they're just saying it exceeds 300%. The total debt in China, as far as a percentage of GDP, is higher than the total debt in the United States. And I wish I could give you clearer numbers on that. But even in the United States, those are hard numbers to get. We're roughly 330% of GDP. Now, having said that, in a growing economy, that's not a bad number. And people go, wait a minute, 300% of GDP, how is that a huge number? How is that not a bad number? Well, if you're in a growing family and you just took out a mortgage, it's likely that your mortgage is significantly higher than this year's income. In fact, it's pretty normal for somebody in a $300,000 house to be making a combined income of right around $100,000 a year. Do you see how there might be a 300% ratio there going on where it's the 1 to 3? It's yep. Normal in a growing situation when interest rates are low for those numbers to look really big. When you're talking about interest rates being as low as they are, people can afford more house because the monthly payment is lower on a lower interest. So having a 300% of GDP, 330% of GDP debt in the United States compared to like the 1970s and 80s, if we'd had that amount of debt, it would have completely bankrupted us. There's no way we could have paid it because that kind of debt at that interest rate, those interest rates were double digits. It was insane. You would simply, the entire budget of the United States would not have been big enough to pay for the debt at those interest rates if we had today's debt. So that's a danger for the future when interest rates are going up, but it kind of gives us an idea of how do we compare to China? China has a greater amount of debt and it's less quality. It's more likely to default on the large amounts of debt that it has.
Both of us have something in common, though. China basically won't allow a major default.
Right.
They would basically start buying up the defaulted debt because they don't want their economy to collapse, which would cause... The problem with that is it would flood the system with yuan, their currency, renminbi. I know it's called yuan and your renminbi, and I never have been able to figure out why one is one when the other is the other, but it's called both.
Yeah, it's kind of like if we were to say that we're officially calling the dollar the buck. It's just another name for it that people have been using for long enough that it's just official now.
The problem is if there's ever a slowdown in the economy, there's a lot of companies that are very highly leveraged in China. A lot of businesses are very highly leveraged. They've borrowed out to the hilt and they continue to borrow to the hilt. The Chinese government recognizes that problem and is fighting it, but it can't, you know, if it began to be defaults, which there could be at any point, as the economy slows down and the Chinese government began to buy it up, it would flood the economy with their currency, which would cause their currency value to drop, which would probably cause some international reactions as the value of the yuan dropped. And it would cause people to start taking the yuan and converting it to dollars. It becomes very complex. Their economy is far more fragile than ours. It's very centrally regulated, and it's a big experiment that goes on. And the big experiment is that they have a centrally controlled economy. We have one that's pretty much not centrally controlled. Now, let me say this. Our major debt is at the governmental level, at the federal level. The Federal Reserve is monetizing that debt right now as it buys about $90 billion a month of government debt, turns it into cash. It's more cash in the economy. How are they going to handle that? I don't know. But it's a relatively minor thing compared with what China would have to do.
Right. And the other piece is that a lot of China's debt at the corporate level is foreign denominated U.S. dollar type debt where they have to pay it back in U.S. dollars. There's not a lot of foreign denominated debt in the United States. We don't owe in euros very often. It's pretty normal to be in dollars. Do you want to say something to wrap up this hour?
Well, I can say that the economy is going like gangbusters, and the stock market is muddling along right now, but really the muddling along is a very, very good rate of return. And there's a shift going on from large cap growth to smaller cap value that is really healthy. And it's generally occurs about the middle of a bull market. So we're still got some room to grow, it looks like.
I'm going to hit one more thing is because it's a compliment from Philip. He's comparing us to finding an oasis in the desert. So we are really dry and have a few trees. So as long as we're compared against the rest of the desert, we're pretty cool. Thank you, Philip. We appreciate that. He said it a little bit more magnanimously than I did, but we appreciate your well wishes. If you would like to talk to us off the air, we actually do give personalized investment advice to people of high net worth and corporations, foundations, and so on. Local number is
254-947-1111.
Or toll-free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can email us, Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.